Tim, come down.
If you had some provocations already ready to go, perhaps, we don't want to.
That way, so you can also incorporate your questions and make that an interactive panel discussion.
So it's interesting. I still work for IBM. We still do this quite a bit. So David mentioned very briefly blockchain. Anybody know what blockchain is? Do you think they know what blockchain is? Yeah. It's misunderstood. If you're looking for GPL on the latest buzz phrases, you're going to start hearing it called distributed ledger technology. The more fundamental as to what it really is in blockchain, we particularly value that. IBM and some of our best buddies, Intel, and many others now, 117, I think, have gotten together and formed something called Hyperledger, which is one of the larger blockchain consortiums. Ethereum had already sprung up on its own. They're competitive in some senses. They have different philosophies. But I can tell you why I've been in terms of that. We can go there. But what's behind that is the fact that there's a recognition that having an immutable chain of ownership that you can track and use can identify things and can identify paths. It'll be used, it's already being used for tracking food, for safety foods, where did this element come from. It's so cheap you can track individual food. Certainly you can track small shipments of food. You're going to see it, well, you've seen it with things like Bitcoin, where we have cryptocurrencies. You can now say, we have identified a value. How you establish a value is interesting. Bitcoin, an interesting approach to that. But there's also Ethereum coin. There's, backing another one now. There's a number of these. What they do is they allow you to say, here's a token of value. So I no longer have to exchange value for value. I can say I've got tokens of value. I will give you some of my tokens, which I will establish value to you the thing that I want. And we track this all through our distributed ledger. So we're very much caught up in this notion of the value of joining public, open, innovative thinking, and then commercializing. My name is Koya. So that was part of, the thing that I find very inspiring. It fits into the systems world. There are a number of places I find particularly interesting in all of this. This open thinking tends to use standardized components. My background goes back a long way in software engineering. 20-odd years ago, the big thing in software engineering was components off the shelf. The idea that you can take standardized components, I'll come back to what that means in a second, and glue them together and make software. And that's what we do these days. Most of our apps on our phones are done by people who've gone off and maybe they've used Node.js or they've used Python libraries or lots of gray hair, no hair. You might use C++ libraries, or even C libraries. Code that was written by other people, and you glue them together in systems. The problem is, software engineers 20 years ago thought that every one of these components would be very carefully described, they would be formally specified, they would be validated, they would be verified, they would be tested out, so each one of these little nuggets would be perfection. So when you glue them together, all you needed to do was look at the tiny bit of code you wrote and say, did I grab the right information from the right place? Did I pass it in the right form? Perfection would happen, and my job would be done. Instead,
I looked at these. I don't update my apps all the time. I have 79 updates to do on my apps. Probably 50 of them, maybe 60 of them, say, oh, we made it a little more efficient, or we regularly fix bugs. Where does that come from? Where is this notion of fixing? So the challenge for you, David, is how with this style, how do you get us back to a place where software does the job it's going to, it was intended to do?
That's a different book, actually. This is some of the work I've been doing on pattern language. And so, again, coming around to things that we learned and forgot and have to reinvent, pattern language is on the agenda.
Okay. And we'll come back. I think that's a worthy topic of discussion.
After taking the time to read the book, I had precious little time to collect my thoughts, so I wrote it down. So I'm going to primarily read what I managed to put down today. So no doubt by now it will be abundantly clear to you why a poll, this by the way will take about 10 minutes. It'll be abundantly clear to all of us now why a whole book is very much in order for adequately containing the scope of David's knowledge and imagination. Those who know David will be familiar with his encyclopedic knowledge of all things in and around systems thinking, including socio-technical systems, management systems, service systems, soft systems, critical systems, theory and systems philosophy, to name a few. Further, I've found David to possess uncommon curiosity and demonstrate genuine intrinsic motivation for discovering whatever best passes for the truth of the matter in any given context. And to say that David is a bit of a stickler when it comes to process would be an understatement of vast proportion. The quality and integrity of the methodology he applies in is essential to his thinking. And when he's thinking about how, even when he's thinking about how to dispense with theory and process altogether and to just let whatever matters most emerge and reveal itself in the present moment. An important aspect of David's process is the dialectic. Maybe he would put it in different terms, but I can't resist the sheer gravitas of intoning the phrase the dialectic on this occasion. If it had its own soundtrack, it would be some part of Beethoven's Fifth, I think. Put simply, if David decides to zig, he would prefer if there were someone available to zag, to serve as the foil and the imminent grounding for his zigging. And so what this means is that it's my duty now to, by David's own request, offer some measure of substantive opposition or critique to some aspect of this book. Though before I do so, I think it's only fair for me to point out several ways that he's clearly trying to hobble my efforts this evening in this respect. First, by evoking our sympathies with his injured foot. Coincidence? I don't think so. Then he invites his family here tonight, presumably to stare me down. Well played, but I'm afraid not. And finally, stooping so low as to curry my favor with tasty post-meeting snacks and refreshments. Well, sorry, not sorry, to say that I have no appetite for that. That said, I will begin by complimenting the work that David has introduced us to just now. David delivers in every way, I think, on the promises of the book's cover and liner notes. More importantly, what follows in the subsequent 600 or so pages is immensely well informed by David's intimate knowledge and firsthand observation and interviews with IBMers, other IBMers, concerning IBM's open source activity over the course of a decade. From this basis in empirical fact and observation, David, as you have now briefly witnessed, offers expansively researched and intricately articulated theories and patterns that illuminate the nature of open innovation learning and offer many intriguing directions for further research, both pure and applied. But even more importantly, I think, is that few areas of study offer the broad scope and rich promise as is embodied in the phenomenon of what we call open source today. The wide-scale, near-universal relevance of open-source approaches today, combined with the profound impact that it's having, across so many human endeavors is readily apparent, and it's only just beginning. So David has chosen an immensely important and timely phenomenon on which to develop theory and inform future practice. For instance, just this past year, AT&T merged their eComp platform into an open source project of the Linux Foundation. The Linux Foundation is built on the successes of Linux, the first open source computer operating system to challenge and in many contexts displace the established commercial offerings from companies like Microsoft and IBM and so on. With this and similar moves taking place in the telecom carrier data center, we see the beginnings of entirely open source telecom providers. And beyond the world of computer software, we have right here in Toronto a newly launched organization called M4K Pharma that has committed to an open source approach to challenging prevailing models of pharmaceutical drug discovery. M4K Pharma is wholly owned by the Agora Open Science Trust, who identify as their sole beneficiaries open science and the public good. Their initial priority will be to develop a treatment for a rare, uniformly fatal pediatric brain cancer presently only treated using radiation therapy with no beneficial chemotherapies available. While these may be stellar examples of open source in its most pure and earnest incarnation, there are also many shades of gray where the open source organizations are concerned. Some open source foundations are created and controlled by close groups of supporters, more resembling what is traditionally called a consortium, open where PR and marketing are concerned, but effectively closed in actual practice. But just like the incremental learning and experimentation of IBM that David details for us, these other various shades of gray represent legitimate experimentation, testing, expansion, and innovation in the boundaries and behaviors by which systems of open source creation and production are rapidly and continually being defined and redefined today. And the influence of open source is in no way limited to software and science. It is influencing mechanisms of policy development, government service delivery, venture and community financing, and much beyond. So while I understand the reason for David's design of the book, why it is the book that he had to write, and quite possibly why it might be the book that only he could write, I personally would have traded a bit of empirical case study detail and some philosophical or anthropological esoterica here and there if it allowed for just a slightly broader treatment and discussion of the progression and impact of open source and open innovation learning beyond the software shop and into the wider world. But alas, there is no room for that. The book is dense, which is to be expected when synthesizing in parallel three distinct case-based inductive theory constructions of both the descriptive and normative kinds, no less. Indeed, it soon becomes evident that in order to make sense of this book, one must construct for themselves, based on the evidence before them, an operational theory of David Ng's theory builder, if you will. In support of such attempts, I offer two brief pointers for approaching this book, overflowing as it does with so much detail, structure, process, imagination, and provocation to further study and learning. My first piece of advice, with apologies to Shakespeare, the first thing to remember as you develop your theory of reading this book is the pattern is the thing wherein you'll catch the concepts of the aim. For those not already familiar with the world, by the way, Shakespeare could have learned a thing from David about doubling his word count. For those not already familiar with the work of Christopher Alexander or technical notions of patterns and pattern languages, such as David just alluded to a moment ago, it will be helpful to learn more about that in preparation for or in parallel to reading David's book. And in the spirit of that, I offer tip number two in the form of a little starter pattern, copious footnoting for disclosing mega worlds of comprehension. I'll say that again, copious footnoting for disclosing megaworlds of comprehension. David might appreciate that. Knowing that a book of 1,000 pages might prove too intimidating for many otherwise interested readers, David has tucked the other 500 pages into the footnotes as made possible by their much smaller font size. Suffice to say, I highly recommend reading the footnotes. Think of it as getting two books, or maybe even three or four books, for the price of one. So, many thanks, David, for this valuable contribution and your careful, comprehensive treatment of what is right now such a crucially relevant area of scholarship. I just want to mention, over the years of our Systems Thinking Ontario group, we've explored complex models of social evolution, the circular economy, a variety of topics in ecological economics most recently, major developments in the field of cybernetics, to highlight only a few recent topics. Nearly any and every subject, theory, thinker, or phenomenon that can be alluded to in a brief title that also includes the words systems and or thinking is fair game for our group, it seems. For the benefit of first-time attendees on this special occasion, Systems Thinking Ontario meets with much less formality, minus the snacks, which again, I'll just say it makes me a little suspicious this evening, and has softened my critique substantially. On the third Wednesday of every month, excepting December, and we delve into a topic of interest to the group and then engage in sometimes lively, though always respectful, open dialogue to more fully appreciate that month's topic. We typically meet in and around OCADU, often in the room next door, over here. And if you're interested in learning more about the group, there's a comprehensive online listing of past sessions and announcements of upcoming sessions. On March 21st next month, we'll be learning about and discussing holistic product design systems for sustainability with Saya here. And you're welcome to attend. You're all welcome to attend. So on this auspicious occasion, just please join me in also expressing our heartfelt appreciation of David's leadership over more than 5 years now in launching and sustaining Systems Thinking Ontario. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Tim. Can I throw out the first question? Actually, and you don't have to answer, we're just going to let it sit there. So one of the contexts in which open innovation learning could be applied that I haven't gotten to that point in the book to see whether it is explored, would certainly be the distribution disruption of education. And with online education and platforms like MIT and Stanford taking the lead with a number of different platforms that you could actually call the wikiing, blogging, distribution of education, and with a theory of learning as well, why aren't we actually seeing that much change in how education has taken shape? I mean, so we've certainly, not that there aren't changes taking place, they're very slow, perhaps, but so it would seem that, you know, one of the ultimate forms of software is in how we teach and negotiate and learn and share knowledge with each other. So it's essential in oral communication, written types of communication. The exchange of knowledge, teaching, learning, and training is kind of an ultimate control or a proto-control system. It's how we often exchange and learn in the first place, before it's encoded into the different practices that could be exchanged this way. So it seemed that would be that your normative theory would apply to developing education. So I could either leave that to explore in different ways, but I wanted to, because the question I was sitting with as a professor and somebody who's, as other people in education, try to change these systems.
Yeah. I'll respond to that.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so we take the learning by doing, learning by making, and learning by trying. So how much in our education system are we actually permitted to do those things? So the learning by doing, getting one thing right consistently, tends to be something that they do.
Training.
Now, yeah. Learning by making, I think that there's actually a turn these days, and so I do... coach students, I was teaching a class and I had one student come up. I gave him the same advice that I give my sons on career. I said, do something real. If you're, like, you have to remember, I was a strategy consultant at IBM for like 12 years. It's not real. Do something real. And you know it's real when you're making something. And so I think there's a turn there. And so this is one of the reasons that I could say I'm hanging out at OCAD rather than at Rockland School.
No.
Is that I believe that the design community is makers.
We don't do MOOCs very well either. We aren't like just putting lectures out online, letting people follow them and do their own thing. We want people to come here and go hands on. That's true.
But the third one of learning by trying, I think, is one that is not well received. Having the ability to fail and taking it as a point of pride should be something that we should be looking at. We need the opportunity to fail. And I get to practice what I preach a lot when I get the opportunity to teach. And so for the past 6 weeks, I've been at University of Toronto teaching. And the students always get in this discomfort phase. So Peter's seen me teach before, but they start off and they think they know everything, and they get really uncomfortable. Yeah. And then by the end of the course, they tend to get comfortable again. But getting to the point and saying that that in that class, I had students prepare content. I gave them, in effect, say 2 hours reading, and then you have 4 hours to create a presentation about something you've never known, you never knew anything about. And these are master's students at the University of Toronto in the information school, and they're looking at me and go, in 4 hours, we're supposed to, you know, present stuff? And I said, well, yeah, but firstly, to be at the master's level, you had to have been really good at school before. You wouldn't have gotten into this program if you weren't good. And so we take a leap of faith here, and you only need to present for an hour, and you look at this stuff. And so all the students presented, and they did a really good job. But then they did the blogging afterwards, and the blogging was the opportunity for you now to see what is it they missed, and that the result of me giving a lecture. But in effect, there's a way of looking at that, which is I led the students to fail. Now, we all understood that the purpose of this course was to learn, wasn't to optimize. And so, like I told them, no one ever fails in my classes. They don't fail. You don't fail. But you have to give them opportunity to make a mistake by trying, and then you go, I learned something. Yeah?
I think the trend that's highlighting is being accelerated and enhanced from open source.
Yeah.
A lot of the motivation or momentum behind shifts in that direction are being driven from the open source movement. I noticed in particular just this week I was looking up a group that was setting up a wireless mesh network in Toronto. Here they transitioned Toronto Mesh. And when you read through their material, it becomes clear that they're not experts in telecommunications. They're not experienced hardware engineers. They're nowhere near the qualifications of the people who, in industry, set up networks, let alone cutting-edge mesh networks, which typically don't even exist much in the world of commercial providers outside of like a really large corporate campus, right, to extend the wireless network. It's cutting-edge stuff, and they're doing it with an ethos, when you read the materials, basically nobody cut anybody else up. It's clear that they know that there's a lot of things they don't. It's clear that they are demanding, if you like, as a token, as your ticket for participation, that you will be willing to fail, be open about failing, allow your coworker or your collaborator in this project to fail, and then you're all here to learn together. And That's a real
shift.
I think open source is
right. Cool. Let's take some questions. Anthony, your hand was already up first. Let me just call you.
So thank you, David, for contributing to the group for all these years. I remember only too vividly that the first System Thinking Ontario meeting that we had, I think, that you presented that. And it was extremely eye-opening during my own master's study, so I wanted to just thank you for that. And also to say that I'd be very curious about why you're curious about innovation. Tonight's presentation has started to answer that for me, so I thank you for that clarity. And then my specific question is, you talked about knowing why, knowing how, and knowing whom, what, where, whom, when, and where. You didn't talk about know what. I'm curious, the context of my curiosity is that if you look at the public policy innovation funding at the moment, and even a lot of the private sector innovation funding, it's all about funding stuff, IP, of one sort or another, which generally speaking is not knowing why, knowing how, or knowing whom, when, and where. And it seems to those of us who are promoting social technologies and social innovations, that there is in fact far more opportunity in these three categories you've identified for innovation than there is in the know what type of innovation. Yet the funding doesn't seem to follow this. And in fact, we have more and more cases of knowing what innovation failing because it didn't also think about knowing why, how, and whom, when, and where. So I'm just curious, why didn't you talk about know what? And could you just sort of give us some thoughts about the current state of innovation policy and funding in the province of Ontario and more generally?
Yeah, sure. So firstly, the ideas of episteme, techne, and phronesis come from Aristotle, and they're the three virtues. So we know why, episteme, and we know universities do knowledge. Techne, which is the know-how, and the know-how is not just an individual thing, it is a group thing. So how do people work together where you get methods from. But Aristotle thought that the ultimate virtue was phronesis, which is what is the impact on people? Also from the branches that are there, episteme, know why, is universal knowledge, but we have the idea in phronesis that it's situated situationally. So it's a context. So if you ever found someone that did something right at the wrong time, that's a lack of phronesis. Now, the work we're talking about on ontology is because I think that people are too focused on the equilibrium idea or the idealist idea that we can get to a certain place and know something. And trying to move away from the teleological goal-oriented of going to get somewhere and getting more towards the idea that we should be learning and progressing like we do in biology, that you make some incremental moves and then you learn from that and then you make more incremental moves is the way I think it should be going. So my criticism of the public policy, I actually don't like the idea of superclusters. Let's put it this way. I compare this to my son, who at Ryerson was thinking about, he did very successfully in the case competitions, because you know students get together, business students, they do these case competitions. And I said, this is a really bad design, don't you think? You get 100 students together, they all work like crazy, and then two or three of them win. This is a really bad system. Why don't you join something that's constructive? So we can look at everything being competitive and trying to create supercluster where we create a spike, but that's not going to be a long-term proposition. I can cite the extreme case of that, having been in Finland doing this research, because I was there in Nokia with 85% of GNP. And that was an aberration. That was not something they should care about.
Patrick?
So, commenting question. You have a really big book to cut down into a small paper. Now, when you graduate in Finland, you're going to get a pot hat and a sword. You can borrow that sword a bit ahead of time. I work in AI, applying AI to fuzzier world problems, and I don't think there's probably a paint in your book I can't directly apply. You had indicated some very powerful forces, symbiosis and so on. I was thinking, did you have any thoughts on autonomous and innovation?
Yes, and so in April, I'm meeting with Jim Spohr in Shanghai and Wuhan, and we're spending a week together. And the direction we're going, so there's four of us, Susu Nosala, who came to the RSD meeting last year, the year before. And I've been working together and with Jim Spohr and with Raphael Arar, who's all the IBM research, the designer for IBM research. We're working on that agenda. But Jim's focus has currently been on leaderboards. So if artificial intelligence is a very big area, and so he's actually running this week in San Francisco, I think, and then in mid-March, he's running in Finland, conferences specifically on areas, in effect, where it is that you want learning in artificial intelligence. So he's trying to create this idea of leaderboards. So we're working that direction. But the direction we're moving is actually less from science and more towards the arts, because we're finding, as I said, science requires history and data, and we're on the leading edge, so we're trying to push through the arts rather than
time. I didn't remember your
name. So David, I wanted to thank you for taking that big step forward and encouraging your students to fail in the learning process. And I think the the challenge that I've seen is that, you know, okay, so certain things in the marketplace support this failure thing, time to market, so you got to get it out there, you fail. However, there's a real big elephant in the room around instant gratification that I'm, you know, that's a challenge that I face in the work that I do, and I suppose many of us do. And I just wonder, you know, in your travels, in your readings, like, how is that playing against these, you know, this need to fail? You know, this, you know, if you fail, then you won't be gratified, I assume. I don't know, where have you seen that sort of dilemma?
So, for me, actually, the division is between the material and the immaterial. And so, most of the things that we fail on, you lose on your pride, but there's nothing real that happens. So, talking about bringing out a new product, and if you bring out a new product, you should bring it out. So, the idea of minimum viable product,
yeah,
like that, right? Yeah. You bring out a product and you learn, and the goal is to learn. If you bring out that product and it's static and doesn't change, then you're going to be in trouble. But for me, the real test is, and what I've learned from the open source community is, it really is all about seeing something material that has to get beyond the top. And most of the stuff I'm seeing is not real.
First of all, thank you very much for this book. I mean, I was not sure whether I'm going to, you know, read it or not. I think I'm going to read it now. So it was really interesting. And I was surprised. I thought that the book would be about pattern language. I was not aware that you were working with staff at the same time, so it's amazing. So what do you think about the way this whole thing influences the business model and the organization itself? Because, I mean, if I understood it properly, it's not only open source, and it's not only about innovation culture that we've been talking mostly about. I mean, it's this sort of interaction between having some innovation taking place outside the ecosystem, and then some insight, and then trying to sort of have the balancing act between those two and equilibrium. So having sort of innovators or designers or knowledge workers inside the organization, which is like a financial firm, producing something to offer, you know, value, deliver to customer, but at the same time having similar kind of process, but very different kind of people who are not your employees, who are just some almost random people from the ecosystem, engaging with you or among themselves on value creation, which is more of the platform. So how do you see that, like it was mentioned, education. So one thing is to deliver education digitally, which is most of the so-called platforms to now with MIT and others. They don't really co-create knowledge outside. And then we have the open source stuff, which is outside. But how do you do, you know, all these things together? And I suppose IBM was somewhat, based on your case studies, working exactly on this kind of hybrid situation.
And so the net of this is that open innovation is a great idea, but IBM probably spent 6 or 7 years before it got it. And it's a big company, and it takes a lot of investment and trust in the people in order to do that. I'm not sure if I answered the question, but one of the things that I've noticed, because I'm studying in Finland, and of course we're across the United States, is that Canada is actually pretty unique right now in that it's following these ideas of openness and immigration and all the open policies we have. In Finland, they've actually turned the other direction, and they've turned a right-wing government. Every time I go there, my friends apologize to the government. And in the United States, talking about moving directions in the as part of the case studies, I included Obama's Open Data Initiative. And if you look at what happened when Obama was leaving and before Trump came in, I had to go back and recode all the pages because it's no longer whitehouse.gov, it's ObamaArchives.com. They've taken all the stuff that Obama did and they preserved on the web because the people were still working on their way out of the White House in January, I guess, of that year. In effect, the United States has taken a step back. So it's not clear to me how we're going to influence the world that way, but Canada is more open to these art sorts of ideas than I'm seeing in the rest of the world. Everyone's going other directions, saying, no, we need more private, we need more secrecy, you know, we need more guns and sort of stuff. That's I think, going the wrong direction.
Any questions over here? The other side, that's fun. So. Okay, quick follow-up.
We should adjourn.
We can talk to, the author and all of us will be available for the reception, if I can join us now. And David, I'd like to just thank you for your presentation tonight and for generosity and sharing the book with the community, with us, community at large, and assistance that you've been there. So. And thanks, Diana.
Thank you.
Please join us.